want to start back into the Heaven series. I have a few questions that I want to answer again. Sorry, that song really got to me. Oh, it's been a tough week, and that really spoke to me. So anyway, three questions I want to look at. We're going to look at, will there be work, will there be money, and will there be technology in heaven? So the first one, Austin asked, will we have jobs and work in heaven? And the quick answer is yes, I do believe that will be the case. If you remember, one of the fundamental premises that this study is based upon is that the new earth and the heavens will be a restoration and a glorification of the original. And that will come into play as we answer this question here. Because in the original creation, Adam was given work to do in the Garden of Eden before the fall. A couple of things he was given, actually. One of which everybody thinks of, and the other one is something that maybe you didn't think about, maybe you have. Genesis 2:15, it says, "And the Lord God took the man and put him into the Garden of Eden to dress it and to keep it." So that's work, obviously. Anybody that's ever dressed and kept a garden, weeded it and pruned the trees and did all those things, knows that that's a lot of work, manual labor. And then Adam was also given some mental labor to do as well in verses 19 and 20. It says, "And out of the ground the Lord God formed every beast of the field and every fowl of the air, and brought them unto Adam to see what he would call them. And whatsoever Adam called every living creature, that was the name thereof. And Adam gave names to all the cattle, and to the fowl of the air, and to every beast of the field. But for Adam there was not found an help meet for him." Now, of course, God could have dressed and kept the garden himself, right? He could have just made it like self-dressing and self-keeping, right? And God could have named all the animals. He created them all. God named all the stars, right? So he could have named all the animals. But he gave these tasks to Adam. The first one was physical. The second one was mental. Adam was the first taxonomist, I think would be the term for that. That would be a lot of work, given the thousands, I don't know, hundreds of thousands probably of different creatures there were on this earth at that time, because contrary to evolutionary ideas, we've lost species, not gained species, as time has gone on. So, you know, just imagine having to come up with names for all these animals that you've never seen before. So anyway, that would definitely have been an exercise in mental labor. So I would conclude from that we will have jobs and work to do on the new earth as well, just based on this pattern alone. And this was before sin entered the world. This wasn't a curse. This didn't happen in Genesis chapter 3 or 4, where God gave him this work to do. This happened before sin ever entered the world. I'm going to be quoting from Randy Alcorn here in his book, Heaven, throughout this sermon today, and as I have in a lot of these sermons. He wrote on page 331, "Work was part of the original Eden." We just read about it. "It was part of a perfect human life on earth. Work wasn't part of the curse. The curse, rather, made work menial, tedious, and frustrating." Genesis 3, 17 through 19. I'll read that to you. It says, "And unto Adam he said, because thou hast hearkened unto the voice of thy wife, and hast eaten of the tree of which I commanded thee, saying, thou shalt not eat of it, cursed is the ground for thy sake. In sorrow shalt thou eat of it all the days of thy life. Thorns and thistles shall it bring forth to thee, and thou shalt eat the herb of the field." Verse 19, "And in the sweat of thy face shalt thou eat bread, till thou return unto the ground, for out of it wast thou taken, for dust thou art, and unto dust shalt thou return." So it wasn't work that was given as a judgment for the curse. It was tedious, difficult, laborious work that would cause you to sweat, that would cause you to work with thorns and thistles, and the land wouldn't be productive as it was prior to sin, and so on. So you always want to remember that, especially when in reference to this question. Alcorn also said, on the same page, he said, however, on the new earth, work will be redeemed and transformed into what God intended, Revelation 22:3, which talks about his servants serving him. I will read that too, Revelation 22:3. And there shall be no more curse, but the throne of God and of the Lamb shall be in it, and his servants shall serve him. Alcorn continues in the quote. He says, serve is a verb. Servants are people who are active and occupied carrying out tasks. So here on, we started off in the original creation before sin entered, and now here we are in the new creation after sin has been abolished, and God has servants serving him. So there was work before sin entered, there's work on the new earth in the new Jerusalem. Now, another way to look at this, another piece of information to put into this question would be our Lord Jesus Christ and his example. And he worked while he was on this earth. He was a carpenter before he entered his public ministry. We see that in Mark chapter 6 and verse 3. So he obtained a skill from his earthly stepfather and employed that skill and provided for himself until the Lord called him to the ministry, which I think is a good pattern for a potential minister to follow, to obtain a skill, learn how to work, learn how to make your own way in this world, and then go into the ministry. I don't think it would be a good idea for a like happens these days, for a kid 18 years old to never have a job, go off to seminary, spend 4 years there, 6 years there, get some degree, and then go and start pastoring churches when he'd never really worked a day in his life in the real world and would have no idea what the real world's like and what all of his people have to deal with day in, day out. It's a good idea to, you know, to do it the way that Jesus did it. Mark 6 and verse 3. And not the is not this the carpenter, they're saying of Jesus, the son of Mary, the brother of James and Joses and of Judah and Simon, and are not his sisters here with us? And they were offended at him. There's a whole lot of preaching could be done in that verse. All I really want, though, is that he is the carpenter. So he was known throughout that area, apparently, as a carpenter. I imagine that he was a pretty good carpenter. Being, you know, wiser than Solomon, and being, of course, diligent and dedicated and honest and trustworthy and, you know, all those things, and putting his heart into whatever he did, I imagine he was a really good carpenter, if I had to take a guess at it. And then afterward, when he went into the ministry, then he did the work that the Father gave him, ministering to people, preaching the gospel, healing the sick, all the way up until his death, 3.5 years later. Let's just look at a few verses here in John chapter 4 and verse 34. So even though he was God manifest in the flesh, and there'd be no physical reason why he would have to work, if he can make bread and fish to feed 5,000, he could make bread and fish to feed himself every day, right? He wouldn't have to work physically, but he had work that he was commissioned to do, so he did have to work because it was the commandment of God that he had to work. But he was independently wealthy, if you want to call it that, so he wouldn't have had to, you know, for any other reason. John 4 and verse 34. Jesus saith unto them, my meat is to do the will of him that sent me and to finish his work. So he was given work to do, and that he did. John 5 and verse 36. But I have greater witness than that of John, for the works which the Father hath given me to finish, the same works that I do, bear witness of me that the Father hath sent me. These works were, like I said, preaching, performing all these miracles, healing people, and they were prophesied. It was prophesied back in Isaiah that he would preach the gospel to the poor, that he would heal the sick, he would give sight to the blind and recover the hearing to the deaf, and so on. So he had all these things that were prophesied that he needed to do, all these works, and he did them. It's kind of summed up here in Acts 10 and verse 38. Acts 10:38, Peter says how God anointed Jesus of Nazareth with the Holy Ghost and with power, who went about doing good and healing all that were oppressed of the devil, for God was with him. And then, as he said earlier, his mission was to finish the works, and when he was in the Garden of Gethsemane praying his high priestly prayer, he said he did. He finished them. He did everything he was supposed to do. John 17 and verse 4. John 17:4, Jesus said here, I have glorified thee on earth. I have finished the work which thou gavest me to do. So we should take our cues from Jesus, and when we're given a job, do it, finish it, right? Don't leave it half done. Follow through with things. When you commit to something, do it. Now, think about this. Jesus was a sinless man. He was not under the curse of sin, and nevertheless, he worked. So this, kind of like Adam in the Garden of Eden, this is another proof that work is not a result of the curse, because Jesus had work to do, but he was not under the curse. He had never sinned. He wasn't being punished for anything by having to work. So work is not sinful in and of itself. I mean, certain type of work could be, but work alone is not. And from that, we can reason, as we have already, that we will likewise work in heaven and on the new earth when we're free from the curse of sin. So I think some of us have this idea that we work and toil down here, but when we get to heaven, it's retirement time. No, it's not. When you get to heaven, you get to work. There's going to be plenty to do up there. Work is not, like I said, a punishment. It's actually a blessing. You ever tried sitting around all day, every day, day after day, and doing nothing? I mean, to me, you want to talk about punishment. That's punishment. Boring. Drive me crazy. I couldn't stand it. All right, I'm going to give you another quote here from Alcorn. He says, this is on page 31 and 30, pardon me, 331 and 332, consider Christ's activities, working in a carpenter shop, walking the countryside, fishing, sailing, meeting people, talking, teaching, eating, doing his life's work. Even after his resurrection, he moved from place to place, connecting with his disciples and continuing his life, a preview of life after our resurrection. And then he says on the same page, yeah. He says, since work began before sin and the curse, and since God, who is without sin, is a worker, and he is, let me just give you a couple of verses here. John 5:17. I'll get back to the quote in a minute. John 5:17. Jesus says, but Jesus answered them, my Father worketh hitherto, which means up until this time, or until now, as yet. And I work. So my Father works. He's worked up until this time. He didn't just work creating the earth and the heavens. He did that, but he worked right up until that time. God's always working in this earth. But probably his biggest chunk of his labor, at least from our viewpoint anyway, would have been when he created the heavens and the earth. That was a lot of work. Only took him 6 days. Genesis 2:1-3, thus the heavens and the earth were finished and all the host of them. And on the seventh day, God ended his work, which he had made. And he rested on the seventh day from all his work, which he had made. And God blessed the seventh day and sanctified it, because that in it he had rested from all his work, which God created and made. So there's your third proof that work is not the judgment of sin, because God worked. Jesus worked, Adam worked, all of which were without sin, Adam at the time, anyway, that he was working. So I think I've made that point pretty strongly and clearly. All right, anyway, so let's continue with the quote. I'll just start over again. Since work began before sin and the curse, and since God, who is without sin, is a worker, we should assume human beings will work on the new earth. We should assume we'll be able to resume the work started by Adam and Eve exercising godly dominion over the earth, ruling it for God's glory. But we don't need to just assume this. Scripture directly tells us when the faithful servant enters heaven, he is offered not retirement, but this, quote, "Well done, good and faithful servant. Thou hast been faithful over a few things. I will make thee ruler over many things. Enter thou into the joy of thy Lord." Matthew 25:23. I did modify his quote by putting the King James text in it instead of whatever perversion he was using. So I think that's a good point that he's making there, which is the same point that I'm making. We can reason it out that we'll work in heaven, and then we can also see there's that parable which is referring to the new earth. We've already talked about that we will have work to do when we get there. We'll work in heaven, both in the present heaven and in the new earth, including serving God, building houses, planting vineyards, and working with our hands and laboring. Let me just give you a couple here. Revelation 7, verses 13 through 15. So this would be in the present heaven, and we'll see that we'll have work to do when we get there, before the resurrection, and we get our bodies again. Revelation 7, 13 through 15. "And one of the elders answered, saying unto me, What are these which are arrayed in white robes, and whence came they? And I said unto him, Sir, thou knowest. And he said to me, These are they which came out of great tribulation, and have washed their robes, and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. Therefore are they before the throne of God, and serve," remember that's work, "serve him day and night in his temple, and he that sitteth on the throne shall dwell among them." So there it is in the present heaven. This is before the second coming, before the new earth is created, and you get servants serving God. And then after the second coming, after the new earth is created and the new Jerusalem comes down to it, in Revelation 22, 3 through 4, we see this verse that we already read before. "And there shall be no more curse, but the throne of God and of the Lamb shall be in it, and his servants shall serve him, and they shall see his face, and his name shall be in their foreheads." So we'll be serving God. We've already seen in Isaiah 65:21 that we would be building houses and planting vineyards. You probably remember that. And I will turn back there because there are some other things that are listed here also that we will be doing. Isaiah 65. Remember, this is the new heavens and the new earth being prophesied of in verse 17. Isaiah 65:17, "For behold, I create new heavens and a new earth, and the former shall not be remembered, nor come into mind." And then down in verse 21, it says, "And they shall build houses." That's work. I put up a wall one time in our old trailer and made one bedroom into two. That was like a week's worth of work. That was a lot of work, putting up a wall. I mean, building a house is a lot of work. Wayne could tell you about that. He's done it. Austin could tell you about it. I think Don and Karen have done it too. I think a lot of people would be able to testify that is a lot of work. "They shall build houses and inhabit them, and they shall plant vineyards and eat the fruit of them." Planting vineyards is obviously work. That's kind of like Garden of Eden type work back there. And then also it says that we'll be working with our hands in verse 22, "And they shall not build and another inhabit, they shall not plant and another eat, for as the days of a tree are the days of my people, and mine elect shall long enjoy the work of their hands." Now, this is talking about the new heaven and the new earth, so there's definitely going to be work there, working with our hands, not just with our minds. And then laboring, verse 23, "They shall not labor in vain, nor bring forth for trouble, for they are the seed of the blessed of the Lord, and their offspring with them. They shall not labor in vain," which means they will labor, but not in vain. Right? So we're going to labor when we get there. But just remember, it's not going to be the cursed type of labor that we have now. It's going to be productive, enjoyable, fulfilling work. You won't have bad days where everything goes wrong and stuff breaks and you get frustrated and irritated and nothing goes right. And you won't have days like that. You won't labor in vain. There'll be no building a house and a tornado blowing it over a year later or something and everything that you just worked for is gone. That's not going to happen, thank the Lord. Now, we'll also have jobs in heaven. And we can reason that out from these parables, and we've already looked at them, so I'm not going to read them again. But you'll remember the parable there in Matthew 25, 20 through 23, and Luke 19, 16 through 19, where he gives the talents and he gives the pounds, and the man that got the five talents makes five more, and he says, "Well done, thou good and faithful servant, thou hast been faithful over a few things, I will make thee ruler over many things." And same thing he said to the man that got the two. And then in the other parable of the pounds, he says that, "Have thou authority over 10 cities," the guy that got the 10 pounds. And then the other guy that got the five, he said, "Be thou over 5 cities." Right, so the men that were faithful and did their work that God gave them to the best of their ability, used the talents that God gave them, they are said to, in these two parables, to be made rulers and to have authority. And I'll define those terms here for you. A ruler is one who, or that which, exercises rule, command, or authority, especially of a supreme or sovereign kind, one who has control, management, or headship within some limited sphere. An authority is found in the definition of ruler, but it's also found in the Luke 19 passage, "Have thou authority over 10 cities." It is power to enforce obedience, power or right to enforce obedience, moral or legal supremacy, the right to command or give an ultimate decision. So, just by the definitions and by what these words portray to us here, we can see that these are high-level jobs. Right? These are not, this is an entry-level work here. This is, you know, being in charge of other people. And we can reason then from that if there are rulers who have authority over cities in heaven, then that means that there are going to be subordinates that work for them. Right? If you have authority, if you are a ruler, what does that mean? There are people that are under you that are doing what you tell them to do, right? If you have authority, it's the same thing. So this very fact tells us that there are going to be other people working for these men. So looks like everybody's going to have a job to me. There's going to be no unemployment in heaven. We're not going to have a 60% labor force participation rate like we have today. Seriously. We have for a long time. We have the lowest labor force participation rate that we've had since like the 1960s or something like that. Which means people that could be working that aren't, that won't. Yeah, it's a mess. All right, now the next question ties into this, because why do most people work? To get money, right? Most people work to get money. They don't do it for the fun of it. I mean, work can be fun, but most people, the reason they go to a job every day is to get money. That's why welfare is such an evil thing, because it prevents people from doing what they should be doing. And there are plenty of people out there, because of fallen human nature, that if you will pay them to sit down and do nothing, that's exactly what they will do. Mankind, as I see it, are basically broken up into three groups. You've got people here on the far, we'll just say on the far, whatever, your right, my left. You've got people here on your far right that no matter what, they wouldn't take a handout. It doesn't matter if government's just going to give you money to sit at home and do nothing. They wouldn't take it, and they would work no matter what. And then you've got, that's a fairly small group. And then you've got another small group that if they could possibly do anything to not work, they would do it. They would steal, they would petition the government, they'd vote for whatever politician they have to do. They would actively work to not work. Okay? So you got these people over here that'll work no matter what, no matter if somebody tried to give it to them, they wouldn't take it. You got these over here that would do whatever they could to get the free money. And then you get the vast majority in the middle. The people in the middle, if they have to, they'll work. If there is no programs or whatever, they'll work, the vast majority here. But if there are programs, they can easily move over to the other side and take the money. There are very few of them that, you know, would move over to the other side. And what happens with the welfare state is you take, you know, you got the bums over here that won't work no matter what, but you got the vast majority in the middle that they would work if there wasn't the welfare state. But what happens is you got the welfare state, and now human nature kicks in, and they move over on this side where they're not going to work anymore because somebody's giving them a check. Right? So that's the evil of the welfare state, is it takes people that would work and moves them over here into the camp of those who won't. But anyway, okay, so the question is, will there be money in heaven? That was just a bit of a rant. Let's first define money. Money is current coin, metal stamped in pieces of portable form as a medium of exchange and measure of value. If you wanted to define money very simply, it's just simply the most commonly used commodity for exchange. That's what money is. Started out as gold and silver. Those were valuable metals, and it made sense for them to be money because they have a lot of value in a small piece. They're divisible very easily. They're indestructible. They don't really they don't rust. They don't rot. You know, things like that. Easy to carry around. Easy to transact in. So they basically became. I mean, money is the ultimate barter. You can barter it. You can barter money. To somebody else for anything. Anybody wants it and will take it because they can use it to barter it off to somebody else to get something else they want. Now, money is not evil, which is evident by the fact that God authorized its use. Let me just give you a couple of verses here, because there's probably a lot of people, I imagine, as with a lot of these questions in this study, I would think that most people, if you said, is there money in heaven? Absolutely not. Because most people think of money as bad, it's evil, people are greedy or whatever, right? I don't look at money that way at all. Money is simply something that facilitates trade. And that's not evil. Nothing evil about that. God commanded the use of money, authorized its use here in Jeremiah 32 and verse 25. So to answer this question, it's first necessary to show that money is not evil. Just like the previous question, it was necessary to show that work is not evil. And once you take that argument away, that money is evil, then we can look at it and say, okay, if money is good, then the question is this good thing going to be in heaven or is it not? Because there are other good things that won't be in heaven. Sex is good. If it's in marriage, that won't be in heaven, right? So just because something's good doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be in heaven. But we at least want to show that it is good. Jeremiah 32 and verse 25. If you think money is evil, try living without any for a while. You'll find out a thing or two. My grandfather, Wagner, said that money is the short end of life, but everybody needs a little. And he was right. Jeremiah 32 and verse 25. And thou hast said unto me, O Lord God, buy thee the field for money, and take witnesses, for the city is given into the hand of the Chaldeans. God told Jeremiah to buy a field for money. Well, money can't be evil if God's telling Jeremiah to use it, is it? Let's look at Matthew 17, 27. Jesus Christ, the Son of God, told Peter to go out, cast himself a hook, get himself a fish, find a piece of money in its mouth, and pay the taxes with it. I wish paying taxes was that simple these days. Matthew 17, 27. Let me tell you what. Pay your taxes these days, you have to catch a whale with money full, his mouth full of money. You ain't going to catch one little fish with a coin in and pay your taxes. Matthew 17 and verse 27. Notwithstanding, Jesus says, lest we should offend them, go thou to the sea and cast an hook and take up the fish that first cometh up. And when thou hast opened his mouth, thou shalt find a piece of money. That take and give unto them for me and thee. So, obviously nothing wrong with using money. Jesus commanded the use of it there. It's not money that's evil. It's the love of money that's evil. That's where the evil comes in. Let's look at 1 Timothy 6 and verse 10. 1 Timothy 6 and verse 10. It says, for the love of money is the root of all evil, which while some coveted after, they have erred from the faith and pierced themselves through with many sorrows. It's the love of money. Nothing, no stuff in and of itself is evil, right? But coveting those things are evil. You know, God says back there in the 10th commandment, you know, to covet your neighbor's ass or his ox or his men's servant or his women's servant or his wife or anything. Well, none of those things are evil, but to covet them is evil. And this is what Paul's talking about here. The love of money is the root of all evil. Now, it appears that there will be money in the new earth. I'll give you a verse here which I think alludes to it. I couldn't prove it absolutely, but it certainly seems like it does. In Revelation 21, 24 through 26, we've been to this verse a number of times in this series. Revelation 21, 24 through 26 says, "And the nations of them which are saved shall walk in the light of it." This is the light of the New Jerusalem. "And the kings of the earth do bring their glory and honor into it, and the gates of it shall not be shut at all by day, for there shall be no night there, and they shall bring the glory and honor of the nations into it." Now, the glory that the kings of the earth bring into the city, I think, is probably pretty likely meaning money. They're bringing their offerings to the Lord into the city. And I'll give you a number of verses here where the Bible uses the word glory to refer to money. The first one is in Esther 5 and verse 11. Esther 5:11. It says, "And Haman told them of the glory of his riches and the multitude of his children and all the things wherein the king had promoted him and how he had advanced him above the princes and servants of the king." The glory of his riches. The kings of the earth bring in their glory into the new city, right? Their riches into the city. There's a There's a verse in Proverbs which says that the labor of the foolish, something because he knoweth not how to go to the city or something. He does all this labor and then he doesn't even bother to go to the city to sell the things that he bought or to go to the city to, you know, to trade the things that he's produced. And not sell the things that he produced. I meant not sell the things that he bought. But anyway, that was just a side note. Let's look at Psalm 49, verses 16 through 17. Psalm 49, 16 through 17. It says, Be not thou afraid when one is made rich, when the glory of his house is increased. You see their glory being referring to riches, and the kings of the earth bring their glory into the city. Verse 17, "For when he dieth, he shall carry nothing away. His glory shall not descend after him." See, his glory is his money. So that's why I say I believe that when it says they're bringing their glory into the city, that's what it's referring to there. And then Paul said in 1 Thessalonians 2 and verse 6 that he, as a preacher, was not in it for the money, as a lot of them are these days. 1 Thessalonians 2 and verse 6. He says, "Nor of men sought we glory, neither of you, nor yet of others, when we might have been burdensome as the apostles of Christ." Burdensome, like living, you know, having them support him financially. He didn't do that with this church. He did take offerings from other churches, but in this case he didn't do it, and I've talked about that before. He did it for a reason and for a purpose, especially with this church in Thessalonica, because they were a good church, but they had a bunch of bums that wouldn't work in this church. You can read about it in 2 Thessalonians chapter 3. He says, "If any would not work, neither should he eat, or neither shall he eat." So anyway, he did this for a reason. He didn't seek any glory from them, any money. So anyway, those are just a few verses which show that glory sometimes refers to money, and it would appear to me that that's what the kings of the earth are doing, coming to the New Jerusalem, presenting their offerings to the Lord. It seems reasonable to conclude that there will be money on the new earth for another reason also. Because remember back in Isaiah 65, we just looked at that in the previous question, and we will be building houses and vineyards, remember that? And building a house requires many different types of materials, which requires many different people to produce it. And I talked about this before when I talked about what we would be doing in heaven, and I said that it's likely that if we're building houses that somebody else is producing the lumber, cutting down the trees, you know, sawing them up and producing the nails and the other materials that are necessary to build a house, which would require mining iron ore and all kinds of things. So there would be a whole division of labor, most likely, unless God just makes all the materials for you and just sets it there and, you know, gives it to you. So that would be possible, but it's also quite possible if God's going to let you build the house, maybe he's also going to let other people make the materials to build the house, right? If he was going to do everything, why didn't he just build the house for you too? So anyway, if that's the case, and you got all these different materials that are needed to build the house, and you'd have men making all these different materials, well, if you just have a bunch of materials and you're bartering for everything, that's very inefficient, right? If you happen to be a vineyard owner and you are producing grapes and you want to build a house and you need nails, well, maybe the guy that mines the ore and then makes the nails doesn't need any more grapes. He's got plenty of grapes. And the only thing you have is grapes because you're a vineyard owner, you're a husbandman or whatever. Or if you're a farmer and you raise cows and you've got milk or something, well, maybe the guy that makes shingles for your house doesn't need any more milk. Right, so trading, that's why barter is a very, very cumbersome form of trade. So it would make a lot more sense to use money. That's why God authorized the use of money in this life to facilitate such transactions. Because the guy that makes the grapes can then trade to some other guy for money, grapes for money, and then he takes the money and then he trades it for the shingles or for the nails that he needs, right? That's, you know, kind of economics 101 here. So it's logical to conclude that money would be used for such purposes in the new earth. Now, somebody who is astute might say, "Ah, but Pastor, you've forgotten a verse, because there's a verse in the Bible that God says, come and buy food and drink from me without money. So therefore, there is no money in heaven." That's in Isaiah 55 and verse 1. So maybe this verse just blows my whole speculation out of the water. But if it did, I probably wouldn't have gone through all the speculation, right? I probably would have said, there is no money in heaven because Isaiah 55:1 says so. But, you know, I like building it up anyway and making some suspense, so to make it a little more interesting for you. Isaiah 55 and verse 1 says, "Lo," then say "lo," it says, "Ho, ho, everyone that thirsteth, come ye to the waters, and he that hath no money, come ye, buy and drink, or buy and eat. Yea, come, buy wine and milk without money and without price." Now somebody would say, well, right there it is. In heaven, you don't need money. You don't need price. You just get whatever you want. Everything's free. Well, there's a couple of problems with that. First of all, the context of the passage doesn't say anything about it being in heaven, right? It doesn't mention it being in heaven or on the new earth or anything like that. So that would be the first thing. And the person that's going to say that this verse means that there is no money in heaven, first of all, has to show me that it's actually talking about heaven. Right? You'd have to prove that, first of all. Secondly, the Lord asked them why they spend money for that which is not bread and doesn't satisfy. Verse 2. "Wherefore do you spend money for that which is not bread, and your labor for that which satisfieth not? Hearken diligently unto me, and eat ye that which is good, and let your soul delight itself in fatness." So, I mean, it's pretty clear he's talking to saints here on earth. But let's just reason through this. So he tells them, why are you spending money for things that don't satisfy? This demands that they were spending money at the time that God told them to buy food and drink from him without money. Right? At the same time he says, buy food and drink from me without money, they're spending money on stuff. He says they are, right? Therefore, money was in use at the time of this prophecy, whenever it is speaking of. Therefore, the time was either during their lives on earth, and the passage isn't talking about heaven at all, or if the time was in heaven, you know what that means? It means there's money in the present heaven. So, this verse does not prove that there's not money in heaven. So, my guess is there probably is money in heaven. But there won't be greed in heaven. There won't be fraud or theft or anything that's associated with money that gives it a bad name. That won't be there. All right, now question number three. Will there be, or three for today, 34 in this study. Will there be technology on the new earth such as cars, computers, electronics, etc.? Remember that I keep going back to the new earth is going to be a glorification and a restoration of the original creation. In the original creation, man was given a mandate to have dominion over the earth. Let's go back to Genesis 1 and verse 28. We've already looked at this verse here probably a week or two ago. Genesis 1 and verse 28. And God blessed them. This is after he created Adam and Eve. And God blessed them. And God said unto them, be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the fowl of the air and over every living thing that moveth upon the earth. So man is here told to have dominion. And this would have been accompanied by using the raw materials that God had put on the earth to make equipment that would enable him to be able to subdue the earth and harness the natural creation to make it work for him. If you're going to rule the earth, well, you're pretty much going to have to build civilizations. You're going to have to build cities. You're going to have to, you know, build buildings. You're going to have whatever, maybe weapons or something to maintain order and things like that, right? You're going to have to, there's going to be all kinds of things that you're going to have to do to dominate the earth, especially after sin enters the picture, which it soon does here. This is going to require building things and making things. Well, that's basically what technology is. It is using skill and craft to make things. That's what technology is. Now, God is a creator. I probably didn't need to tell you that. Genesis 1:1, in the beginning God created the heaven and the earth. Peter says that that God is a faithful creator in 1 Peter 4 and verse 19. And we were created with a mind and a body capable of designing and creating amazing and beautiful things which improve the quality of our lives. We're made in God's image. I missed that part. So God's a creator, and we're made in God's image. Let's get that. Verse 27. I skipped the point there. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him. Male and female created he them. So the creator creates his creation in his own image. What's that tell you? It tells me that we have some creative ability also because we were made in the image of God. We're made like he is. And indeed, God has given us the ability to create. Not to create ex nihilo, I think that's how you say that, that's Latin for out of nothing. Not like God, we can't just create something out of nothing, like he did, like just create a universe by speaking it into existence when there was no material to begin with. But we can take the material that God has created and we can mold it and form it and modify it and make it into something else. And that's what technology is. Let me just give you an example here of God giving wisdom to men to be able to do this very thing. Exodus 31, 3 through 6. Exodus 31, 3 through 6. The Lord says, I have filled him with the Spirit of God, in wisdom, and in understanding, and in knowledge, and in all manner of workmanship, to devise cunning works, to work in gold, and in silver, and in brass, and in cutting of stones, to set them, and in carving of timber, to work in all manner of workmanship. And I, behold, I have given with him Aholiab, the son of Ahisamach, of the tribe of Dan. Why can't all the names be like Dan, easy to pronounce? And in the heart of all that are wise-hearted, I have put wisdom, that they may make all that I have commanded thee. So God does not only give wisdom to be able to make good decisions in life and, you know, things like that, to have a good and fulfilling life and to please God, but he also gives men wisdom and knowledge and understanding to be able to do things, right? To be able to do a craft, to have specialized skills. Because not any Joe Schmo can just pick up some tools and start working in gold or silver or brass or carving wood, right? Most people can't. How many of you can work in gold and silver and, you know, I don't know anybody that can, right? There are people. I do know a guy. I know the owner of the jewelry shop downtown, Jordan. He can do that, but the rest of us can't, right? So you have to have specialized skills to do these kind of things. And hewing stones and, you know, making great buildings, that's a highly specialized skill that is probably just about dead. I think if we tried to, I say we, like society, whatever, tried to build some of the old cathedrals like they did in Europe way back in the day, or the pyramids or something in Egypt, you're talking thousands of years later. I don't know if we could build those things now. I don't even know how they did it back then. That's an area of huge speculation. But anyway, the point is that took high technology to make the pyramids and to make some of the great feats. You ever see some of the ancient Roman architecture? Like the Parthenon, I think it was, and some of that stuff is just incredible. I can't even wrap my mind around how they would have built that, and they didn't have cranes and, you know, stuff like that that we have today, hydraulics, and I have no idea how they did it. But somehow they exercised wisdom to make that technology. So a lot of times when we hear technology, we think computers, cell phones, electronics, but there's a lot more to technology than just that stuff. So here God gave these men wisdom to make technology, in other words. Let me give you a couple of more. Exodus 35, 30 through 35. Exodus 35, 30 through 35. And Moses said unto the children of Israel, See, the Lord hath called by name Bezaleel, the son of Uri, the son of Hur, of the tribe of Judah, and he hath filled him with the Spirit of God in wisdom, in understanding, and in knowledge, and in all manner of workmanship, and to devise curious works, to work in gold, and in silver, and in brass, and in the cutting of stones, to set them, and in carving of wood, to make any manner of cunning work. And he hath put in his heart that he may teach both he and Aholiab, and the son of Ahisamach, of the tribe of Dan, them hath he filled with wisdom of heart to work all manner of work of the engraver and of the cunning workman and of the embroiderer in purple and blue and purple and in scarlet and in fine linen and of the weaver, even of them that do any work and of those that devise cunning work. So these men actually had the Spirit of God to enable them to do these type of skills. Now, I'm not going to reason from that and say that everybody that has skills to do incredible things has a Spirit of God. I don't think Elon Musk is exactly, you know, filled with the Holy Spirit or anything. But they nevertheless have skills given to them of God that they can do amazing things. And let me give you one more. 1 Kings 7:14. 1 Kings 7:14. We ought to be thankful that God has endowed probably a very relatively few people in this earth with those kind of skills to be able to make these feats of architecture and technology that we have, because if it wasn't for those really few smart people out there that can make all this stuff, we'd all probably be a bunch of primitive tribesmen because at least if it was all left up to me, we wouldn't have any big old stone buildings or computers or anything else for that matter. So that takes a special kind of skill, which probably not very many people have, but I'm glad that there are some people out there that do have it. 1 Kings 7 and verse 14. And he was a widow's son. This is speaking of Hiram, king of Tyre. And he was a widow's son of the tribe of Naphtali, and his father was a man of Tyre. So Hiram, this is the guy that helped Solomon build the temple, provided the cedar out of Lebanon for it and the stones and things like that. This guy was half Jew. He was his mother was a Jewess. And his father was a man of Tyre, a worker in brass, and he was filled with wisdom and understanding and cunning to work all works in brass, and he came to King Solomon and wrought all his work. If you've ever seen pictures or read the description of what the temple looked like, it was a magnificent building. Solomon's house that he built with the help of Hiram was was it 10 times the size of the temple? I just read this the other day. Yeah, four times the size of the temple, and all outfitted with these enormous stones, and they hewed, I think that's the word, they hewed all these stones ahead of time. And then brought them in, so that it wasn't like they built them out of cement or something like that. They hewed these great big stones, just the right size, and then built the buildings. So they weren't working at the building site. They weren't chopping stone and cutting stone and things like that. They did it ahead of time and brought it in. That would take a high level of technology, because when we build stuff today, you pull out the saw, you measure it out, you make a cut, you put it up there. If it doesn't fit, okay, we'll do it again or whatever. I mean, you shouldn't have to do that, but that happens, right? But in those days, they planned everything out and got these stones just the right size. And that takes some incredible planning, some incredible intelligence to do something like that. So we're talking a really high level of technology here, I think. Alcorn said in Alcorn is not the Bible, by the way. In page 444, he says, God's instructions and his delight in the gifts he imparts to people to accomplish these tasks make clear what we should expect in heaven, greater works of craftsmanship and construction unhindered by sin and death. So you think about what fallen man could accomplish and has accomplished in these great feats that fallen man has done. And imagine when we don't have sin corrupting our minds, and when we do have greater capabilities, imagine the types of things that we'll be able to construct and craft when we get to the new earth. Now, it's a mark of wisdom to find out knowledge of witty inventions. Witty inventions are not evil. Proverbs 8 and verse 12. Now, witty inventions can be used for evil, but they're not evil in and of themselves. Like the old gun debate. Only stupid people think that guns are evil. What's a gun? It's a piece of metal, right? It's a piece of metal that's been engineered in such a way that it can fire a projectile, which can be used for fun, which they are a lot of fun. You ever want to convert somebody from being an anti-gun nut to being a gun nut? You want to convert them? Let them shoot a gun. That's the best way to convert them. You put an AR-15 in the hand of some flaming liberal, and I guarantee you, probably 9 times out of 10, he's going to want one. Because those things are fun. I even saw Piers Morgan, the Brit that used to be over here on cable TV, and they basically banished him from the country because he was such a flaming liberal. But anyway, he was a big anti-gun guy, and he had Alex Jones on the show one day, if you know who he is. And I think it was during that same segment, they took Piers Morgan to a range and let him shoot an AR-15. And even that guy had to admit, he's like, man, that's a powerful machine. And he's like, I mean, he couldn't hardly contain himself from saying, that was pretty cool. And so I'm telling you, you want to convert somebody, it's not by arguments. Just hand him an AR-15, show him how to shoot it. You'll convert somebody into a gun lover. Or any number of guns, for that matter. So, anyway, witty inventions are not evil. Guns are not evil. Yeah, they can be used for evil. cars are not evil. They can be used for evil too. You know, you can mow somebody down with a car just like you can with a gun. I mean, butter knives aren't evil either. They're great for spreading butter, but you could murder somebody with one if you wanted to. Or you could try. It would be pretty hard, but it's possible. But anyway, I think you get the point. Proverbs 8 and verse 12. I, wisdom, dwell with prudence and find out knowledge of witty inventions. See, this verse doesn't actually say that wisdom or a person that has wisdom makes witty inventions, but that he or she finds out knowledge of witty inventions. So it's a mark of wisdom to go out there and find witty inventions that other men have created and use them for yourself. It's a lot easier to use an invention that somebody else has made than it is to make one yourself. You ever try to make a computer? Now, good luck. You'll never have one. But you can search out witty inventions, find somebody else that did, and get one. So it's a mark of wisdom to do that. It's like I said, these inventions are not evil, inherently anyway. Some inventions are. God says in Ecclesiastes that, lo, thou hast made man upright, but they have sought out many inventions. But those are mainly religious inventions, spiritual inventions, inventing them up idols and false gods and things like that, and false means of worship. So I see no reason why we would not use our God-given intelligence and capabilities to design and create godly and helpful technology on the new earth. Especially when you look at technology broadly and not specifically. Because if you look at technology like building a nice stone building of some sort, right, that takes technology to do that, well, what would be wrong with that? Well, if you can use technology to do that, might you use it to make other things, more advanced things, like maybe cars or airplanes or something like that? I don't see why that would be out of the realm of possibility. So could this technology then include cars, computers, electronics, things like that? Well, I would say if those things were only used for godly purposes, then I think it's possible that we might be allowed to create them. I doubt anybody's going to be making nuclear bombs on the new earth, right? Because I don't see any use for them. I mean, they are kind of cool to watch explode if you don't get, you know, radiation poisoning or something. I mean, they are, it would be kind of neat. It's like a big fireworks display. But I doubt there's going to be any hydrogen bombs on the new earth because those are pretty much, you know, only used to destroy. But what about other things that can be used for good, like cars or computers or electronics? You know, those things aren't inherently evil, though the computers and electronics certainly are used for a lot of evil. But this is just my speculation, and it's based on this reasoning from some of these basic principles that I've given you here this morning. I'm going to end here with a quote from Randy Alcorn again. He says, "We do know, however, that the New Jerusalem will have streets and gates suggesting conventional modes of travel. If citizens only walked, perhaps paths would be enough, or maybe sidewalks or something like that, paved trails or something." That was my commentary. "But streets may suggest the use of wagons and horse-drawn carts or something more advanced. Will we ride bicycles and drive motorized vehicles? Will we travel to other places outside the New Jerusalem in airplanes? We don't know. But we should use the, quote, why not, unquote, test. We should use the why not test. Is there anything sinful about wheels and motors? No. Unless you're a Christoplatonist, which is a word that he made up, but a Platonist is somebody that follows the philosophy of Plato, and Plato thought that material things are evil, that the only things that are good are the things of the mind, the spiritual things. So a Christoplatonist would be a Christian that believes that material stuff is evil, so there'd be no money in heaven, there'd be no technology in heaven, there wouldn't be any of these kind of things in heaven because all this material stuff is just inherently evil. Unless you're a Christoplatonist, you realize the answer is no. Therefore, there's no reason to assume we won't enjoy high-tech modes of travel on the new earth. Now, we don't know for sure whether we will or not. But I don't think there's any biblical reason why we couldn't have airplanes or cars or things like that on the new earth. Now, maybe we won't need them at all. Maybe we'll be able to fly, which is the next question that you're going to have to wait until next week for. So maybe we won't need those modes of transportation, but I don't think it's out of the realm of possibility that we could have them. And that's all I have to say about that this morning, so I thank you for your kind and patient attention.
Just a quick note at the end of the sermon. The most important thing a believer in Jesus Christ can do is to be a member of one of God's true churches. If you're not already a member of one, go to pastorwagner.com/churches to see if there is a true church or other believers of like faith near you. That's pastorwagner.com/churches.